Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey folks, Mark Unsung Podcast, joined by my good friend Professor Christopher Cusack.
No, I'm just back to
Sorry, his glasses are off today.
Yeah, pedestrian. What's going on with the less words?
I don't know, I just prefer it now, I think. If you don't know who we are, it's worth your breath.
What's the new script? Hello folks, Mark Unsung Podcast.
Aye, Chris, joined by Chris.
Aye. It's like you're texting.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. People know at this point, right? They got to know.
Do you think text will become so normalised as a mode of communication that we'll start speaking in text?
No.
All right, okay. Moving swiftly on. We're not alone here, Mark. We shouldn't fight in front of
Let's
company.
Let's not fight in front of the children. We're joined by the lovely Kyle Wood, lover of Taunty Monsters. Hello, Kyle.
Hello.
How are you today?
All right.
We're all very emotional today.
Yes, that's code for hungover.
Yes.
Three hungover gentlemen.
Yes. Kelly and I were in the same place yesterday. You were not with us. So.
No. I'm accordingly the least hungover. Uh-huh. But then again, my level is way below you guys. Kyle, you've been off the sauce for quite a while, largely. But I think you probably still can handle it better than me.
I don't know. I didn't drink that much last night.
Do you drink the big glasses?
Yeah, well...
I used the wee baby sippy cups and I still get smashed.
So. Yeah. It's like I was like one pint of cider in and I was...
Fleeing.
Aye.
Having a bad time.
Sometimes that's the only way to make sense of a night.
Definitely.
Especially the places you hang it.
Exactly. No comment.
So, Lovers Turn to Monsters. Kyle, I always understood that as being your solo project, but it is somewhat ballooned into basically an orchestra of emotions.
Hold me like a mother would, like I've always known. Somebody should yell, although tomorrow it don't look that good.
Again, it's pretentious, but I've always seen it as more just the umbrella that I put over any creative output that I have, whether it's in just me involved or other people, or mm-hmm. whether it's videos or art, or it's all just Lovers Turn to Monsters.
So Lovers Turn to Monsters is, well, certainly in recent years, a fairly permanent fixture of the Glasgow kind of alternative punk, emo, indie scene. You kind of straddle quite a lot of genres. I've seen you on bills alongside out-and-out indie acts. Like, I've seen you open acoustic for some pretty avant-garde stuff, and I've also seen you just on straight-up punk rock bills. So, yeah, you're nicely placed. And therefore, it feels kind of appropriate that we're covering an act this week, your choice, who has a lot of parallels to that. You know, it's not one person's act, but it's quite easy to sometimes conflate the name and the person and everything, you know. So do you want to tell us who that is and what we're going to be covering?
Really feels like a Stars in Your Eyes out intro.
It does, doesn't it? I've got a false RAPAC allegation as well.
Yeah,
brilliant. That'll come back around.
Thematically.
Yeah.
Poor Matthew Kelly. So we're going to be speaking about Bright Eyes.
Yes.
A project of Conor Oberst and Mike Mogus. Mm-hmm. We're going to be speaking about the album Digital Ash and A Digital Urn.
Speakers on a TV stand, just a turntable to watch. When the smoke came out our mouths on all those hooded sweatshirt walks, we were a stroke of luck.
Just quite an atypical Bright Eyes record.
It's the outlier of his discography of, I think if you asked most fans, it would be at the bottom of the pile, mm-hmm. or somewhere near the bottom, because it kind of falls out of step with everything that they'd done previous, basically. Mm. So.
But not you.
But not me. There's a few people out there. I had a few conversations last night, like, in regards to doing this, and had a few people agreeing and being like, what are you talking about? That's a beloved album. But it's not.
You'd be amazed how many of my nights turn into people really pulling us up on things that we've said in this show.
Yeah, it does happen from time to time.
So it's nice that you managed to do that before the recording rather than after.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, Mark, we get any admin to get out the road first?
Yeah, so we've got a Patreon. You've probably heard of it.
We heard of Patreon?
Yeah,
or heard of ours?
Heard of ours. If you're on the show, you've probably heard of ours.
I've not heard of either.
No. Jeez, why are you here? So our Patreon is for the nominal sum of four, whatever your currency is per month.
That's four. I mean, there's often more than 4 weeks in a month, so we're basically asking for less than one currency per week for this top level content. I mean, what these shows are averaging about an hour. We're putting two out a week plus a third, and God knows we spend enough time behind the scenes. So if you like this show, if you enjoy it, even if you don't like this show,
just give us hate money.
Take some pity on us, for God's sake. But yeah, we would really appreciate it, because it's a very time consuming and enjoyable enterprise, but yeah, certainly time consuming. And the more we get, the more we can afford to do some of the more elaborate episodes, especially because they take a lot of research. We just came off the back of four episodes on Turbo Folk,
which is intense.
Which was
different kind of intense than Bright Eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I told you at the time I had 12,000 words of notes for that. Unlike Kyle, a man here who knows this subject so well that he's going in naked.
Yes, literally and metaphorically. I'm sweating.
I mean, I have a lot of respect for that. I mean, that is a sustainable form of podcasting, because my 12,000 pages of notes are whatever.
Definitely not.
I spend most of my evenings going down this very route, so I'm well practiced, I think.
That's good. So yeah, as Mark says, please, what are the benefits of paying four somethings a month?
Well, you get access to our AAA Facebook group if you still use Facebook. I mean, I know all your boomer parents are using it, you're probably not anymore, but if you are using it, you can get access to that, and you can go in there and actually have a say in what episodes we do, or just chat shit to us. We really appreciate that too. You get episodes a couple of days early. We release on a Monday usually. These come out on Friday. And also, you don't get any ads, which I think is now probably quite a big selling point.
Yeah, that's not. I don't know what the ads are that are going in.
I know. The most recent one was a ScotRail ad.
So really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's like region specific. Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Am I comfortable promoting ScotRail? They fucked me over quite a few times.
Yeah.
Oh, this would be interesting if we did this bit and then they had an advert in it. See the fucking prices of tickets for. Oh my God, man, they're ridiculous. And they got such a monopoly. There should be an investigation into that. Like, let's hope that it gets nationalised again.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Fuck you, ScotRail. Thanks for your money, though.
I think it is nationalised now.
Yeah, isn't ScotRail, that's what ScotRail is?
Yeah, it used to be, and then it wasn't, and I think it is again.
Okay.
It was a Bello that used to be the run people.
I don't know, but I mean, the fact that a 45-minute journey costs me as much as it would cost me to get to fucking Paris or something, it's like, anyway, yeah, so that's interesting. I didn't know that. I was thinking it'd be something for like the States, like Gatorade or something.
No, it looks like it's like regional specific, so we'll probably get like first bus and all that kind of stuff.
Fucking started in first bus Parks a Denny. Oh, bet you okay.
But anyway, let's move on for that.
Oh my God, I'm getting a wee bit hot under the collar here.
Let's move on for that. Yeah, so
they banked on this when we went into the world of like endorsement and Jesus. Right, okay.
We've sold our soul to the devil. It's fine.
Next, it'll be Glasgow City Council.
I don't get any money for ads, mate. I don't think that's going to...
They got fucking 60 quid off that band last night, didn't they?
30 if they paid in 14 days.
Anyway, sorry. So we're going to do a podcast about music. And then once we stop recording, I'm going to get the rest of this off my chest. Okay, make your case in 30 seconds, and then we're going to pick all that stuff apart.
Okay. Bright Eyes, Digital Ash, Digital Urn. I think it is unsung as a Bright Eyes album. I think it carries the most weight lyrically, thematically, tonally, production-wise. That's pretty much, that's really the main crux, I'd say. I think Conor Oberst has a very distinct style of writing. Mike Mogis has a very distinct style of production. And I think that album kind of is like a left turn on everything that they'd done previous, and then even everything that they'd done following it. Like they kind of take bits and pieces from like stylistic choices and that they've done, and then put it into later stuff. But as an album, I think it's like bursting at the seams.
So one thing that sort of enabled that, and we will go through their catalogue a wee bit, but one thing that enabled that was because this was released at the exact same time as another album of a contrast in style.
Yes.
So it wasn't so much that they, you know, by committing to a different production, they were completely abandoning their sound, because fans could also pick up this completely separate record, which is called
I'm Wide Awake It's Morning. What do you drink it till you're blind? And if you swear that there's no truth, and who cares? How come you say it like you're right? Why are you scared?
I'm Wide Awake It's Morning. And therefore they could sort of cater for their OG sort of like, this is the sound I want from this band, whilst also dabbling in this new territory. It's quite an interesting approach, that, because when you make a stylistic left turn, as you're saying, it can alienate a lot of people, especially if it's only partially successful or whatever. So it allowed them to test the water with a different sound and see how it went down. Mm-hmm. How, just off the top of your head, how did it go down as a kind of ardent Bright Eyes fan?
Bad.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, as I was saying this to Mark when I was discussing this choice, because it came in my head, I've seen someone posting like on Twitter being like, hot take, this is the best Bright Eyes album. And then I was like, I think it is. So then went back and looked at, say, like the original Pitchfork review. And I think that, like, I believe one of the quotes from it was basically, the songs are fine. Like that was that, I think, yeah, that's as far as it got. Whereas like I'm Wide Awake is full of what probably most people would consider like his best writing and his best lyrics and his best like production, and it's really sparse and Emma Lou Harris sings on it and shit. Like there's,
it's weird. So this sort of came across as like a deformed twin, you know?
Yeah. I believe contextually, I think, again, I try not to think about the fact he was like 23 or something when they'd done this.
Oh man, yeah, we'll talk about that in a second, how he's been so prolific and started off so fucking young.
I believe Mike Mogis had just had a child, and then one of their friends had passed away. Mm. So I think those were his kind of two major like writing topics at the time. So I think he kind of tried to separate them. And the idea is supposed to be that Digital Ash is supposed to be representative of death, and I'm Wide Awake It's Morning supposed to be representative of the beginning of a new life. Mm-hmm. And like that's obviously shown in like the artwork with like I'm Wide Awake being like, it's like a knitted sun coming over a like apartment building, and then Digital Ash is all pure black basically.
Yeah.
It's interesting as well, because if you go into their Spotify page, like pretty much all the songs from I'm Wide Awake It's Morning are like the top songs, and First Day of My Life is like by far and away the biggest song mm-hmm. that they've ever had. Yours is the first face that I saw. I think I was blind before I met you. And I don't know where I am, I don't know where I've been, but I know where I want to go. And so it's not even the best song on that record. I think Lou is probably a better single, but yeah, that song's been synced so many times. It's been mm-hmm. TV shows, it's been in adverts, you know. And
one of the Kardashians posted it on Valentine's Day this year.
Holy fuck, there you go.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
The one that's married to Travis Barker because she's just discovering music for the first time.
So's he.
I think he's not quite there yet.
Okay, well, we'll do a bit of the old due diligence. Okay, so Bright Eyes, am I right? I mean, it's largely revolves around three people, right? It's Conor Oberst, Mike Mogis, and Nate Wolcott.
Yeah.
Formed in Omaha, Nebraska in 1995, initially until 2011, had a sort of extended hiatus thing, and then 2020 until present. From about 98 till 2011, they were on Saddle Creek Records, which is founded by his brother, Justin Oberst. Mm. I understand that label was founded as part of like a class project on entrepreneurship, right?
Mm-hmm. They actually tried to find, again, I sold all my DVDs last year, which I really regret, but there's a amazing documentary called An Evening with Saddle Creek, mm-hmm. About the beginning of the label and all that. I tried to find it online running up to this, but couldn't find it anywhere. So
Mike Mogus helped found that as well, mm-hmm. didn't he? Mm-hmm. But then he gave up his role in the label.
I think it was one of Mike Mogus's early bands. I think it was one of the kind of first bands they tried to release, right, I'm sure. Okay.
I mean, that label is very important for Omaha and for that sound of music, you know, like even bands like Cursive and stuff would release records, and we'd done Cursive a long, long time ago. Aye, so there's probably a whole episode on Saddle Creek, mm-hmm. that we could do, mm-hmm. because it's just so influential. Mm-hmm. And is it still going?
Yes, but I think it's...
Connor doesn't seem to be involved with it.
Yeah,
anymore.
No, because Connor left. He started a label himself, I think maybe with Mike Mogus.
Was it Team Love?
And yeah, he'd done mm-hmm. Team Love, and I think Team Love's still running as well, but then I don't even know if Connor's...
They sold their shares in that to, I think it's Warner that now run Team
okay,
Love.
Okay, got it.
Well, they came back in 2020 and worked with Dead Ocean.
We released all their albums in 20, and actually just to kind of circle back to a point about Digital Ash and Pitchfork, I think they
Pitchfork works, and I mean that could catch. Yeah.
Did they not give the reissue like a 9 out of 10?
Yeah, that's probably usually where it goes when mm-hmm. with these things, like a formal apology.
So wait a minute, so the Pitchfork initial review was pish,
yeah.
And then the reissue review was them trying to get on the right side of history.
It's the one.
Which we've commented on many times in the past. Yeah. Go and see the Pitchfork episode.
Oh, a good companion.
Do you remember the number on the original one, roughly?
They actually reviewed them together.
Oh, okay.
So they didn't review, like, they didn't give them a separate number for each one.
Pretty stupid, eh?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So
that's pretty daft.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I can't even remember the number the Dome.
But when it was reviewed, it was...
Nine.
Which is very high for Pitchfork.
Best reissue, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay, well, Mark, you kind of hinted at it. Conor Oberst's been playing music since he was basically an embryo.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
The first one I'm familiar with is that Commander Venus project. Did they have anything before that?
Yeah, he done, I think, two, maybe three solo tapes prior to that.
Was he not like 13?
Yep.
Yes, mm-hmm. they are. Wild.
I mean, I did solo tapes when I was 13, but I don't count them as fucking solo tapes. Man.
It's the intensity. The intensity is still there. It is insane.
Right, well, I'm going to have to go and find these and cut them in, right?
So what is your actual take on those early records then?
There's moments. There's definitely like something there, but he like sounds like a strangled cat, mm-hmm. like him, and he's like 13 and singing about insane, like intense shit, basically. So it's but yeah, I think so. There's Water. Oh, what's the other one called? I think it's called like My Life is a Movie or something. No, that's not right.
Here's to Special Treatment and the soundtrack to my movie.
There we go. So yeah, they're hard to like come by, but like they were released on, again, I was going to say not to go on a tangent, but I'm pretty sure that's the whole point of this show. They were released on a label called Sing Unix, which is a label run by a musician from Omaha called Simon Joyner.
Can I just say, is that the word eunuch? What is that word?
I think it's eunuch.
Like as in like
E-N-U-C-H.
Like, U-C-H. No genitalia.
No, it's like, well, it's like E-E-N-U-C-H-S.
Yeah.
Yeah, Unit K, you're right, aye.
Interesting. Yeah. Name. Okay. For releasing records by little boys.
It was the 90s, man.
He's 13 years old, all right. I don't think we're meant to inspect.
But Simon Joyner is basically... There's a handful of musicians that kind of run like the tape scene in Omaha, like in the 90s, and it's one of those things where if you go back and listen to them, you're like, oh right, yeah, that's just Bright Eyes. Like Simon Joyner he's an incredible songwriter, though. Like I think he just Conor Oberst obviously mooched around that scene, and they were like, why is this child here? And then he gave him a tape, and they were like, I guess we'll release it for you, young man.
It's fucking mad, isn't it? As an adult, you bust your ass to try and get anything released. There you go, 13-year-old Wayne's putting out tapes that are now listening to around the world.
I don't think there was a lot going on in Omaha, apart from the tape scenes.
Yeah, I bought, there's a four-track vinyl from Sing Unix, and I bought it off like Discogs, and it was like in like mint condition or whatever, and it still had the typed catalog index for Sing Unix. So like obviously I couldn't help myself but like looked at it and seen like it's like Conor Oberst's Water, and I was like, you could have bought that then.
Cool. So not long after that, though, he got involved in Commander Venus, and funnily enough, mentioning Cursive, that was with Tim Casher, who went on to start Cursive, right? 1995 to about 1997, is that right? Two albums, Do You Feel at Home for 95, and then The Uneventful Vacation, 1997. I mean, just basically wee guys going at it. And Conor was about 14 in the first one, and he sounds it.
This is the sound that's very, very apparent on Water. I was saying this again to Mark, that like Tim Casher is already Tim Casher, though. So it's weird, like you hear Conor kind of yelping away, and then Tim Casher comes in, and you're like, oh, there's the guy for Cursive.
It sounds like a wee guy asking you to buy him a carrot when you say no. Fucking buy me a fucking
carrier,
a big wank.
Well, so, Tim Casher would have been approaching 20 at that point.
He could have bought the carrier.
Totally bizarre.
So yeah, I mean, Commander Venus is kind of loose, trashy, slackerish indie, meet with a wee bit of emo. The two vocalists are generally pretty messy. Their voices are obviously very loose. They haven't learned to lean into the looseness, though. So it's like, loose vocals is a total thing. We'll come back to that in a second. But he sort of has a handle on it now, whereas back then the vocal is just loose and all over the place.
I think both of those albums are like a massive jump, though, as well, in between them. Like, I don't know if it's to do with touring or whatever they've done, but Do You Feel at Home's a mess. Like, as a tool, I obviously completely love and adore it. But then Uneventful Vacation, everything starts to seem a bit more together, and I think like Conor Oberst's vocals start to sound very like the Conor Oberst that everybody knows. And like, there's a song on Uneventful Vacation, which again, a few drinks deep, I'd probably could put up a pretty good argument that it's one of the Conor Oberst's best written songs.
Oh, okay, which one?
It's called We'll Always Have Paris.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the vocal style a wee bit, right? Because the wobbly vocal approach, I mean, I'm not really sure how it would be referred to. You know, we had a Sprechgesang recently, which was nice that somebody had actually formalised a term to describe something. But this kind of like purposefully weak, wobbly, almost like someone struggling to sing. Like, it sounds like they're on the breaking point of not being able to sing. It's like common in slacker rock, certainly. I think... maybe it was part of its genesis to Neil Young, especially given the country flavours, because Neil Young was always a weak singer. That was part of it.
Did I see you walking with the boys, though it was not hand in hand? And was some black face.
You know, it was very sort of human and very relatable. I mean, he could sing some really nice things from time to time, but he had that weakness, that frailty to his voice. The Velvet Underground, another one.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling by my side.
They really leaned into that weakness of singing. I've thought of like a bunch of more contemporaneous sort of examples. So obviously Sonic Youth, that kind of continuation for Velvet Underground, okay. Sparkle Horse and Mark Linkous.
You are worth hundreds of sparrows. A tree you planted has become fecund.
He did a lot of that, although more so earlier on. Later on, it got a little bit more cultured. Elliot Smith, as you say.
Everything is exactly right when I walk around here drunk every night with an open container from 7-Eleven.
Likewise, Elliot Smith could do really strong vocal performances, but then there are big chunks of his career where it's deliberately sort of very weak, and that kind of matches with the lo-fi production though. Granddaddy.
Hewlett's daughter loved her father, and I think she loved me too for a little while.
Deliberately a really thin vocal, a really like weak sounding vocal. Mercury Rev.
Slamming her eyes, locking the door, she collapses down upon the ocean floor. Again.
Covered that, the Mercury Rev, the vocals in it at times are... like, see some of the live performances by Mercury Rev. As much as I like the songs, the live performances are so weak, not hitting the notes, just completely sugarly, like sound that they're just vibrating apart. I just don't enjoy them. It's really odd to see them on a big stage and be like, it's shit. I mean, that is the song, but this is shit. Someone else that made use of it, I think it's Beck. Beck kind of leaned into it, part of that slacker thing. Pavement. A lot of it in Pavement, and that's a kind of approach to it that's almost like a bit knowing. Like Pavement's take on that was like they kind of played on the fact that it was sometimes spoken, sometimes dead sugary. And I think maybe around about that period, you know, that kind of Pavement era, there was probably like Dinosaur Jr. You know, Jay Masses had a lot of that in his voice as well, deliberately like saying at the top of it, like it's straining like that. It's like it's an acquired taste though.
It was like he was in the room there.
I like to think he's not, because apparently a bit of a knob. I've been in a room with Jay Masses actually.
You're not in a lift with
Jay Masses?
I've
been in a fucking lift with Jay Masses, and he wasn't very friendly at all. So
he's known for being very cantankerous for
sure. Yeah, I was going to say that's kind of what he's known for.
If you want to feel like Jay Masses is in the room, I'll fucking let you know. But aye, so I mean, can you think of any other examples of that deliberately kind of like shaky vocal approach?
Cool.
Are you saying Kyle? Or
no, well, no, that's there we go. That, no. that's also fair. I also can't sing.
That's not what I meant.
See, the audience just don't have the benefit of you turning your head inquisitively
just
there.
Just clarifying.
To them, it just sounded like you were like Kyle.
who else can hit those notes? Mark.
Yeah, definitely. Now it feels like Jay Masses is in the room.
you pretty much covered almost all the bases of that kind of scene. Going back to the tape labels of the like Omaha, that was very much their vibe. Simon Joyner, I'd say Simon Joyner's more in the kind of like Lou Reed. He's a bit kind of like got a kind of deeper, a bit of a drawl.
Aye.
You know the kind that comes with a key. You can throw in the lake or bury somewhere. I thought about the kid you knew.
And then there's another singer called David Dondero. David Dondero, he's probably more in tonally with Connor.
Up the creek here to downstream there. If you break my heart, you pay for it. You break my heart. You bought it.
To the untrained ear, I'd say if you played a David Dondero song to someone who had a vague knowledge of Bright Eyes, you could sell it as a Conor O'Bear song. Like, that's how close they are in stylistic.
It's definitely a thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We were talking about how the Sprechgesang has made such a resurgence now, and it's a sort of easy solution to the problem of like, okay, I've got a band, I've got ideas for a song, you know, I can learn the guitar, but unfortunately the voice I've been born with, yes, you can train a little bit, but you're largely stuck with the voice that you've been born with. And so finding a solution to the problem of how do I make this music when you've got a weak vocal can actually, you know, it can be the thing that trips up a lot of otherwise really good bands. So the Sprechgesang thing is like quite a convenient, easy solution that allows a lot of other people into the market. Like, oh, you've got this great idea for the instruments, just do this over it and that's fine. And that's actually really popular right now. So I think there was also a period where that style, I mean, certainly the early 90s, when you had the really lo-fi grunge stuff. It wasn't grunge, but it was kind of parallel to grunge, you know, like Sebado and Pavement and bands like Dinosaur Jr. and stuff like that. Frank Black to some extent as well. Like, that kind of thing was quite in vogue, to not be a trained singer, because it was almost like a pushback against Eddie Vedder. You know, it was almost like a pushback against eggy, you know, over the top voice. It was like, oh, this is a nice thing. You have the same with female singer songwriters, where you had a lot of female singer songwriters that had very fragile voices, or you had like the Coco Rosie thing and stuff like that, where they were unconventional and they were working out a solution to the problem that wasn't like, let's get somebody with an amazing voice.
Sky blind. Crumbling walls never sweep away my memories of children's things, a young mother's love before the yearning song of flesh on flesh, young hearts burst open.
Like, let's actually do something else with the vocal. And it's made a bit of a comeback, certainly with the resurgence of kind of Pavement-y type bands. There's quite a few local bands that do it just now. I'm not sure though that I can think of too many bands that are doing it the Conor O'Bear way. I mean, that is more of an emo sound, mm-hmm. and less of a kind of American college slacker
sound.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, there's, again, with, I'd say there's some kind of Midwest emo energy in, say, Commander Venus and stuff, and the way that they deliver.
Especially the second one.
Yeah, but as you said, I don't think it's more leaning towards the kind of Mike Kinsella, American football and all that type of thing.
Yeah.
That style more now.
So maybe, because I realise you all are really very keen to hear my hot take on Bright Eyes, you did suggest this was part of the reason for suggesting it in the first place.
Well, anytime I've listened to the podcast, it's always just been like, I'll see like a title episode and go, oh, Chris is going to hate this. But then you shock us, because again, when I went, I was saying this to Mark as well, like when I went through a kind of spiel of listening to you constantly, just was very shocked at how passionate you're about Tori Amos, which is I'm here for. But yeah, I can remember seeing the episode and being like, oh, Chris is gonna hate this.
Those are real feelings. So in terms of Bright Eyes, I got into it initially via very fucking slow dial-up. You know, the kind of websites where you could download one track overnight. So yes. When I was staying in Stirling with my friend, and he had a computer set up in the front room, and I would go on to like sites that were sort of aggregators of certain styles of music. I think I've talked about Epitonic in the past, and basically they had sort of one or two tracks by all these different bands, and then there was like a bit of a link thing, you know, if you like this, get this. And this is actually via that site, it's how I got into Blonde Redhead. I think I mentioned this in the Blonde Redhead show. It's how I got into a load of like June of 44 and the Shipping News and stuff like that. And another one was Bright Eyes. So on that site, they only had about three or four tracks, and I just took them, and I didn't know the context of them really. I didn't know what album, but I believe the bands had actually okayed it by that site. I think that's how it worked. And so I had a big CD of random tunes, and the tune by Bright Eyes that made me, at least for a while, consider myself a bit of a Bright Eyes fan was Halai Halai. And I really did like that song. I still somewhat like that song. I don't think it's aged all that well, but that kind of got me into it. But far more exciting to me was when I first heard Desaparecidos. So they brought out an album called Read Music Speak Spanish in 2001, I think it is. And I remember the Virgin Megastore in Stirling carried it. And you're kind of at the mercy of what places get in, but they had this album. And I just kind of liked the look of it, realised, oh, I've actually heard this guy, and I fucking love that album. It's the opiate of the populace. We need some harder shit now. The truth's getting round. Each public school is a halfway house. We're hot. Like, I think that's a genuinely a really good album. That's an album I would happily bring to the table show. I remember, I think I'd seen it in Kerrang, of all things. I think that was where I'd first kind of realised and joined the dots. Yeah, and they gave it a really glowing review. I was very much sold in that. And then once having heard that, going back to investigate Bright Eyes in more detail, I just was not getting the same buzz at all. I was just like, the songwriting, the vocal style, I liked it in the context of the really rambunctious, clattery, weird post-hardcore.
It's odd that he's very, very good at that. Again, jumping back to, like, say, like Lou Barlow. Lou Barlow's an incredible, like, hardcore singer, but then also can do the quiet mumbling, and I don't think there's many people out there that can do that, and Conor Roberts definitely can. Like, he can go from the, like, the delivery in that album's incredible, man. Yeah, who's got time to die? Floors are clean, the color scheme of comp will mess me every time. So no one stars in this cattle town. The semis pass make you squeal. Yeah, I mean, I think that overwrought voice on the edge of giving out thing worked really well in the context of that music. And it just, when I went back to Bright Eyes, I just wasn't getting the same sort of buzz, as I say. But I mean, Desaparecidos did reasonably well. They ended up touring with Jimmy Eat World, and The Promise Ring began to really make some waves, but they went on a hiatus as well, like 2002 to 2010. But they came back and did a second record, didn't they?
Yeah. Paola. Mm-hmm.
Signed with Epitaph as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were a project that I was really into. I have never really gone back to them, but that record is quite definitive for that sort of 2001 period, because a lot of the other stuff I was listening to around then was like Tool and stuff like that, and I was pretty stodgy, and there was the danger of becoming one of those Tool dudes, you know, like fucking Joe Rogan listener, you know, like I think stuff like Desaparecidos and At The Drive-In and things like that helped me avoid going too far down that road. The fact that they were kind of dragging me back to this noisy kind of Midwest clattery sort of stuff. So I have actually a wee bit of a debt to the Desaparecidos record. A lot of time for that one. Is the second one good? Paola?
I think so. Like, it's one of them where it's clear that they've taken a long time to write it, you know what I mean? So I think they're a band that are obviously only going to do it if the songs are there and if the energy's there, and like, it's there. There's some absolute storming tracks on it, like really, really good.
It always kind of seemed analogous to me with Burning Airlines, J. Robbins' band, because the first Burning Airlines album, a bit like the first Desaparecidos album, I found that so fucking exciting, that album. I love it. In fact, I still love it. And then they brought out Identikit, the second one, after a while, and it was just not there. Like, you couldn't get the lightning back in the bottle.
Well, Piola was released in Epitaph, so like, you'd have to be able to turn some CDs heads if you want to get a record release in Epitaph. Yeah.
But by that point, you're dealing with Conor Oberst of fucking Bright Eyes, so it's like kind of a done deal, you know? Like,
true.
Every Kyle in the world is going to buy it.
And Bright Eyes had been gone for a few years at that point, though. They'd stopped. He was on his solo thing, wasn't he?
Yeah, for sure. So. It's still, even with his solo stuff, though, he was still kind of making a name and getting fair reviews and all this for everything he was doing. So,
but yeah, let's do a little bit on his discography, because I mean, it's not excessive given the number of years he's been active.
His discography is excessive. Bright Eyes, well,
yeah,
is,
sorry,
it's not.
I stand corrected. You're absolutely right. Yeah, the Bright Eyes discography it's got a fair few things in it. So we'll kind of work our way through. I think it's 10 studio albums, 11 EPs.
Obviously, they've done the
Re-releases
this year.
Okay. And there's a collection of rarities and stuff as well, isn't
there? Yeah.
Well, start at the start. A collection of songs written and records, 95 to 97, released in 1998. Full album of those home taping demos that we're talking about.
The heat comes in distant shifts to fill up my room.
Pretty damn lo-fi, pretty rough at the edges. I think it's obviously one for the completists. I'm guessing you're into it.
Yes. It has a very special place in my heart. I think actually the first thing I ever recorded me singing was a cover of a song on that collection.
What song was it?
Called Falling Out of Love at this volume.
That's a really fucking good song.
Yeah, they've turned it into it. It's a fantastic song, even at its lowest, like lowest five form. But like, it's now, it's like a staple in their set and all that now. So
yeah, they re-released that on their companion EP as well. We recorded it.
Tell me what you wanted to hear. Let me do the right thing. Let me do the wrong thing. If it's ever this clear, I'll only say it once. Just let me turn the.
It's got a lot of Weezer feel, that one.
Again, in the documentary that I mentioned earlier, Mike Mogis says, I think it was that song that he heard and was like, oh, this child is writing. Like, you know, he's got synths and he's got like electric guitar and he's like starting to layer and build around rather than just being him and a guitar, like, which the first few collections kind of are. And then I think that was where Mike Mogis stepped in and was like, you can't record songs.
You wee man, step away from the desk. I'm curious as to, and maybe this is a little bit of my suspicion of the appeal behind Bright Eyes more generally. There's like a relatability to Bright Eyes. And, you know, the fragility of the vocal, the style of the songwriting, the way that, you know, the things he writes about as well, they're quite relatable. For you, especially with this record, is the appeal that you can see your own development in that collection? Like, oh, I did stuff like that. I demoed songs that, you know, they weren't that song, but they were very similar. Is there something very relatable about this aspect of Bright Eyes that makes it feel attainable? Maybe that's what I'm going for. Bright Eyes feels attainable. He's good at it, but it feels within reach.
We escape from the house as the day disappears from the sky, and tonight we want it to be like a dream.
It's a very different experience to, for example, listening to Guns N' Roses or Pearl Jam or Tool or whatever. There's something, it's like, I could fucking do that. I could do that. And when you hear this early stuff, you're especially like, ah, fuck, I could do that. I'm on that route.
Yeah, I think when I was younger, definitely, like when I first heard them, I've always leaned towards that type of musician, or like I've always leaned towards like the kind of one or two people just having this kind of big vision. I'm more interested in like watching these other people like in where they can go with it, rather than being like, oh, I could see myself doing that. Like I could see myself making a country record, but I'm not going to. Mm-hmm. You know, and
cultural appropriation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, maybe that is something to do with why I love lo-fi music in general, is the idea of attainability. But I think it's more just to do with, I'm obsessed with rough sketches of mm-hmm. everything. So particularly like listening to, I can still listen to the collection of songs and enjoy it and like pick up on new things here and there and find little imperfections that really like still grab me, you know.
Mm. I mean, these kind of releases are very insightful,
yeah,
in an artist's development. We spoke quite a bit about this in the Nirvana episodes, where I was saying how much the Outcesticide stuff thrilled me, because I was like, oh, I've done stuff that is sort of like that. Like it made it feel relatable. It made it feel like these artists, even though they'd ended up somewhere fantastic, had gone through a similar process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, you can feel the DNA, the sort of inherent DNA of the songwriter is right there. And when you start trying to do something like that, you start to realise that actually there's a bit more to it, that maybe this person's internalised, mm-hmm. that you just don't have or you need to work towards. It's, I mean, because, like, this is 1995 to 1997, so he'd been writing songs since 1992 at this point. So he's, you know, he's released three solo records, so he's done the work, you know. These are probably the best of the ones that you had.
Yeah.
That were not, I mean, are any of these songs on his solo records?
No.
No. So there you go. So he's kind of working down on all the songs that he thinks make whatever Bright Eyes is in his head, whatever the distinction is between Bright Eyes and a solo project, for example, whatever that happens to be for him.
And you can see on the re-releases that they've done, it's kind of like they've went back and revisited songs from each album and have re-recorded like four of them. And you can see they sound like Bright Eyes songs, like they haven't changed massively, like they've obviously built around them, but the songs are there, and it's clear that the song, as you said, like the songwriting DNA has been there from the start, type of thing. Mm. Like, and particularly from that collection, you know, that's why they kind of were willing to put that out, because I think release wise they actually released that after the first one, so
yeah,
like I think they were happy to be like, by the way, this is what we were doing. Mm.
So, as you say, 1998, they also released the first album proper, Letting Off the Happiness.
But you get 6 months to adapt, and you get two more to leave town. In the event that you do adapt, we still might not want you around.
10 tracks, obviously more focused. Features contributions by Folk Philly of Montreal and Neutral Milk Hotel and stuff, like pretty good caliber of people. The second one in this kind of stood out, I know he's been asked about it a lot, is it Patrick My Prince, which is a fictional account of the death of a little brother, which he didn't have.
I heard her say once, Patrick My Prince had all but died. She went out marching. You cried but no one came.
The vocals in that are an acute example of that wobbly, overwrought emo thing that he does. Very shaky, and obviously, as I've said, that manifests as a kind of heartfelt sincerity, a kind of I need to get this all out regardless of ability, like the emotions are bursting out of me and I can't control it, so I'm just going. I think the act of doing that, it's not punk music, right, but it has a punkness about it, because one of the things about punk music was that the people were quite often not very technically gifted, but they had an act of catharsis, and the art was the act of catharsis. The art wasn't the act of playing the song incredibly well. So fucking, like, most of the Sex Pistols were not great in their instruments. Most of that scene, actually, a lot, like, some of the bands had one or two people in them that were particularly good that held it all together, but a lot of the other players were just, it was more about the energy, more about the act of creating and the act of expression, and sometimes even quite violent expression. And so I think like there's a similarity, there's a punkiness to Bright Eyes in that sense, especially early on, because you very much get the sense of like it's an act of catharsis and kind of destructive creation. It's very imperfect.
I think like the standout of that album is that you can feel like the basement around them. Like you can tell that it's just a bunch of people in a basement with like a four track who are just like, let's just nail this, let's just go for it. And I think it like really, really, really comes across, like, as you said, as an act of catharticism. And like, there's just something very warm, I think, about that album.
I mean, musically, doesn't really do anything for me. It was interesting to hear somebody at the early stages of their project, you know, just something that will come up. Is there's the artistic decisions made in this band that are just not decisions I would make personally, and as a result I sometimes find it very hard to connect emotionally.
Kind of bounce off it a little bit. I mean, there are some highlights on this for me. If Winter Ends is a really good song, you can really see the step up in songwriting.
I give myself 3 days to feel better, or else I swear I'll drive it off a fucking cliff. Cause if I can't learn to make myself feel better, how can I expect anyone else to give a shit?
One of the most interesting things about this band's discography is you get to see the songwriting step up and step up at least a couple of occasions on every record, where he becomes a better singer, they get better at arranging.
I think that's a, like, the jump, again, obviously we'll move on to that, but the jump of arrangement from that album to the next one is insane.
Yeah, pretty much.
It is.
The City Has Sex is a really good song.
And there's a boy in a basement with a four-track machine.
It's kind of a country thing, which they obviously lean into quite heavily as the career goes on. It's got a nice little synth part.
I was just going to say that on the creative decisions, obviously, knowing my music, I would probably lean into those decisions. And but In the City Has Sex is, like, for some reason, one of my favourite small bits is just it's the stop and then just a little synth run.
Yeah.
It's insane. Like, every time it happens, I'm like, it's one of them where if I'm having a conversation with somebody, I have to be like, stop.
The re-recording has got what did you say her name?
Waxahachie.
Yeah.
He has sex with himself, I suppose, as the concrete collides, the scenery grows, the lonely ones bandaged, laid fully exposed, having undressed their wounds for each other.
And it really works, man. She does a vocal on it, and Connor comes in the second verse, and it's like a really good reimagining.
Waxahachie is like one of my favourite songwriters of all time, and I really didn't like that.
Really?
I really didn't like her singing. Wow. It was weird. I don't know why. Like, see, when I seen her name attached to it, I was like, oh my God, Kate Crutchfield singing City Has Sex. I'm going to have the time of my life. Then it came on, I was like,
not having the time of life.
This is not right. Yeah. There's something, I don't know if it's to do with, I think, like, Kate Crutchfield has quite like a low, somber tone, whereas obviously like a 17-year-old Conor Roberts is, particularly in that song, is gone off his nut, basically. Yeah. So,
like the role reversal there, where the woman's taking the lower part and the male's taking the high.
Pixies all over again.
Yeah.
During the West Coast is good. It's really lo-fi. The mix is really close. Like, the vocal mix is almost like it's in your head close.
California, where they understand the weight of human hearts. See, sorrow gets too heavy and joy it tends to hold ya. The fear that it eventually departs. The truth is I've been dreaming of some tired,
which is a totally bizarre decision, but it's kind of disconcerting, but it really works for that song. Just to bring up on the re-record, because this is going to come out of my next, so I need to bring it up. On the
re-recording,
spoiler alert. On the re-recording, they've got a cover of St. Ides Heaven by Elliot Smith, which is actually a really good version.
Yeah,
good version of that song.
Everything is exactly right when I walk around here drunk every night with an open container from 7-Eleven. Say not telling. I've been out of horns.
I mean, I guess, right, well, we're going to bring this first part to a close soon. I think the last thing I'd touch on, though, before we do that and before we get into the real big hitters of his catalogue, or of Bright Eyes, of their catalogue, we just talk about Every Day and Every Night EP from 1989.
This is how I got into the band. This is the first thing I heard about the band.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, a girl that I was seeing at the time was really into Bright Eyes, and I actually went out and bought this, had this on CD.
I had one desire.
I got into my CDs a long time ago, but I had that, and yeah, I mean, a couple of songs in that I like, still really like. Mm. A line allows progress, but a circle does not. It's just such a good song, man. Mm-hmm. And Tim Cashel's voice in it is fucking perfect as well.
I mean, it's interesting the way this EP seems to alternate between, there's kind of like, almost like druggy country music with Lap Steel and stuff, yeah, and then there's this rowdy, clattery emo punk, mm-hmm, as well. It's quite varied. Actually reminds me at points of Two Gallants. You know, the there's kind of a loose, ragged, drunken vibe. See, his vocal in this.
Weren't Two Gallants on
Saddle?
Yeah, they were on Saddle Creek,
Creek as well. So yeah, there's like, when he's doing the loose vocal in this one, it sort of veers into almost slurred territory, like, ah, there's a bit of that, and it's got that sort of, is this a drug? You know, it's a little bit ambiguous, mm-hmm, in that sense, and that reminds me of them. Towards the end of this EP, they start to really muck about with production, which I guess foreshadows Digital Ash, as we're going to see.
Are you talking about Neil O'Hara? When,
yeah,
it goes down beating electronic.
Aye, yeah. And it also veers a little bit towards mumblecore. You know what I mean? It gets so incredibly downbeat.
In the morning when you throw up water, and your skin turns a pale, pale yellow. Well, every day you lose more color.
Yeah, I mean, that's an unsettling song, I think. It's that and A New Arrangement, both back to back, are kind of weird and creepy songs, which you hadn't really heard or had a vibe from the band of that. It's actually quite a dark EP as a result. A Perfect Sonnet as well is, it's just him and a guitar, but it's got that massive moment of catharsis in it. And then it does do these kind of strange things towards the end.
I think that EP is obviously where you have to start speaking about Mike Mogus, because obviously, like, taking production, I think, given more freedom in a bigger space, obviously, with, like, mild success from Letting Off the Happiness, they were then like, oh, well, we can go to a studio, we can pay for this, we can do that. And, like, Mike Mogus is clearly not somebody who shies away from trying to like reinvent the wheel to an extent with some stuff. So I think that's, like, as said, where it then kind of like just brilliantly like goes from that onto the next album, I think.
Yeah. And the next album's a biggie, so I think it's probably a good point for us to take a pause, go on a career hiatus. Mm-hmm. The second episode, we'll come back in with Fevers and Mirrors.
Okay, I'll see you next episode.
See you next episode. Kyle.
Same.
Toilet break.
Next episode.
Take a splash cold water in your face and go over that hangover, mate.